This is the Walking Home from the ICU podcast. I'm Kaylee Dayton, a nurse practitioner and ICU consultant. I help teams create awake and walking ICUs through evidence-based sedation and mobility practices. By hearing from survivors, clinicians, and researchers, we'll explore how to give ICU patients the best chance to walk out of the ICU and go home to survive and thrive. Welcome to the ICU Revolution. There's been a lot of online discussion about whether or not early mobility during mechanical ventilation is safe, feasible, and beneficial. If you've been listening to this podcast, you already know. Of course it is. I love hearing about the expertise and experiences from people all around the world. I'm excited to have Sabrina Eggman on now to share her team's COVID experiences in Switzerland. Check out her latest article in the Lancet Journal that discusses the need to have better classification of, quote, adverse events, unquote, during early mobility. I'll add the link to this and her studies in the show notes. Remember, every episode has a transcription and usually citations, so check them out on the website. Sabrina, welcome to the podcast. I'm so excited to have you on. Can you introduce yourself to the listeners?
Thank you very much for the invitation. Hello, everyone. I'm Sabrina Eggman. I'm a physiotherapist in Switzerland. I work in a university hospital. We have about 30 intensive care beds and 30 step-down beds. We treat everything from neurological patients to cardiac patients to medicine patients. So we have a mixed unit. And I've been a physiotherapist there for the last 17 years. I also do research and did my PhD on early rehabilitation in the ICU. So how can we train these patients?
Research is where we really became connected. I recently saw a post from you about one of your recent publications. Can you share that with us?
Yes, a master's student of mine, she analyzed the data, our data, how early patients sat on the edge of bed during the COVID-19 pandemic in Switzerland. And this has just recently been published in the Physical Therapy Journal. And I think we will discuss it much more.
Let's get into it. How did you conduct the study?
So it was a retrospective observational study, and we included all patients that were COVID-19 confirmed and also with COVID-19 pneumonia, so the really, really sick patients. They also needed to be in our ICU for at least 72 days. This was so that we could compare them to earlier data that we already have to see if we mobilized worse or better.
Had it been in the ICU for 72 days or 72 hours?
Hours, of course. Okay. Yeah, 72. No, not days, hours. Yes. And okay. They didn't have to be mechanically ventilated. They just had to have a pneumonia. Yes, and admitted to our unit. And then we collect all this data routinely. So we had a look at our data management systems and we pulled all these data out and analyzed them accordingly.
And what did you find?
Well, we included 168 patients. Most were excluded because they refused general consent, and also some that weren't ventilated for 72 hours. Otherwise, the data would have been even better. So we included 168 patients, and we found that they sat at the median time of 4 days. So that was pretty good. But we also found some differences between a moderate ARDS and a severe ARDS. So those with severe ARDS, they sat substantially later. This was 7 days, and the others with moderate, they were 2.5 days. But all patients, median was 4 days. So that's pretty early for COVID-19.
No, absolutely. There's a lot of fear about mobilizing these patients. And yet fairly early on, you were mobilizing. I worked in a wake and walking COVID ICU, and most patients were awake and at least setting up, oftentimes walking 24, 48 hours after intubation. The sooner we did it, the less likely they were probably to develop severe ARDS. I mean, that's my own observation, but there were obviously there were severe ARDS patients in that high acuity COVID ICU, but not everyone is prone and paralyzed. I mean, they were the exception. Otherwise, they were awake and walking. And this isn't because that ICU received a lower acuity of patients. I was working telecritical care. I was part of the transfer unit. We were just sending anyone that had an open bed, any patient from all over the region. So it was really interesting to see the role mobility played and the level of severity that these patients developed. But what else did you find? Did you measure any outcomes on those patients?
No, unfortunately, we didn't. Because it was a retrospective study, we could only collect the data that we routinely measure and enter into our data system and structurally enter, so not free text. And we mostly enter free text outcomes as free text, so that was difficult. So this we could not really analyze, but we had quite a low mortality actually overall in our hospitals. I just need to check that in the article so that I do not say anything wrong. I think it was about 25, but I cannot say exactly. Where is it? 77% survived ICU. So that was quite high.
And your team already had a good baseline culture of early mobility, correct?
Yes, because the trial we did in 2012, we started actually. We already did a trial on early mobilization and also bed cycling. And since then, we have quite a good culture. And actually, our data was even better than before, even though they were much sicker with high SOFA scores and higher Apache scores.
That's remarkable. And yeah, throughout the pandemic, mobility really fell to the wayside for most ICUs, it seems, especially those that didn't have a strong mobility culture at baseline. And the reason was said to be because these patients were so sick, we could not mobilize them. Why do you think your team was able to mobilize patients so much sooner than the rest of the ICU community, even though we were all treating COVID patients?
Yeah, I guess we already had the experience. And they were really sick. That's, I can confirm that. They were really a challenge to mobilize. And one thing that we had to take special care was like to go very slow. So, for example, you had to take much longer to sit a patient on the edge of the bed. For example, we turned them to the side and then we waited for about 5-10 minutes until they got back their breathing, their oxygenation was back on like we wanted it. And then we just lifted the head of the bed slowly. And then again, we had to wait 5-10 minutes. And only then did we set them on the edge of the bed. So sometimes you need a 20 minute until they sat. So it really took a long time and a lot of breaks. But I guess the culture helped.
And that expertise, really, yeah. I touched a lot of that on the podcast. I think that's something I've intuitively done and witnessed in that awake and walking ICU, because that ICU is a medical surgical ICU. We've always had a lot of interstitial lung disease patients, a lot of ARDS patients. And for a long time, we've mobilized patients with high ventilator settings. So I don't think I've appreciated the skill set of what you just described. To work someone through. I mean, I think now that I'm training teams, I appreciate that there's a lot of fear. So whenever you see oxygen saturations drop or work of breathing increase or the heart rate go up, there's an inclination to just stop, cancel everything, and maybe discuss this tomorrow.
Yeah, and go back and yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think it really needs a high skill set. Sometimes maybe just, oh yeah, you mobilize, do your thing, it's easy, and everyone can do it. But I honestly do not believe that. And the COVID pandemic also showed how difficult it was to mobilize these patients. I mean, it wasn't just to turn. I mean, it was to turn slowly, and then you could do respiratory exercises, for example, in the new position. You could teach them how to breathe even on the ventilator. You could just hold their hands. And and the skill to go just up slowly and really try that they have a good position and know when you can go further. I think that was really challenging, and it helped that we already did this for a long time.
And how did you know? How would you describe? Because I don't know how to describe it. When a patient is recovering, maybe their oxygenation has dropped a little bit, and you're taking a pause. How would you describe knowing, like having that hope or that faith that there's a good chance they will be able to recover and continue to advance in their mobility?
Well, with time, we knew a bit how the COVID patients reacted, because they, interestingly, they all reacted the same. You just had to go very slow, or that was our experience. And so we knew that if we go slow, that we can achieve it. With time, we just saw that. And I guess we needed a bit of time until we found that out. But we, in our study, we included all the data. So from the first wave until the third, I think, which was a bit more than 1.5 years. But then in the second wave, where we had a lot more patients than in the first wave, we already had the experience. We already knew how to do it, and because there was a much higher workload, but we knew that we can do it already from the first wave, where we had a bit more time. Even though we were very close to Italy, we had a bit more time to get to know these patients.
And I don't know how to capture the, and maybe in the research, the value of that kind of experience to say, I have mobilized previous COVID patients. So when I'm in this moment with this COVID patient, or with any patient in general, but especially one that's acting a little nuanced, I know that this is how they likely will respond. I know that it is safe and beneficial to sit at the side of the bed, even when they are so sick. How do you think we get the rest of the ICU community to develop that skill set?
I guess that's really difficult. I think it is. That's the culture, right? The culture we need to teach everyone. And I guess it is talking about it. It is also sharing experiences. Like, for example, we go to an international unit and see how they do it, and exchange experiences, or how do you do this, and talk about it. Conferences, of course, as well. But I don't think we can really, well, I'm not sure if we can research it really.
Right. Like, how do you really give them personal experience through the research?
Yeah, I think our study, I mean, it showed a bit that we have good numbers. So we hypothesized, of course, why do we have the good numbers? And then, of course, one reason is because we have the culture. So it probably supports the culture, because there were a lot of horrid data out there after more than 10 or 20 days, even sitting for the first time. So
your team already knew the sooner we sit, then the better their outcomes will be.
Yes, or they already know how to do it also, and that they can do it even though it's challenging. We did mobilize with ECMO as well, though we found that ECMO was a significant barrier. As well as high SOFA scores.
And because how they responded to the mobility, or because of maybe the personnel it required?
I think rather because they were really, really unstable. Our unit is not a wake and walking ICU as you advertise, but well, it is a unit that stops sedation early and has light sedation protocols. And we walk patients, but I wouldn't say that we can do it with everyone, and not everyone is awake. So, so of course, some were heavily sedated and also on neuromuscular blockers, so they couldn't walk. We had very, very unstable patients also. I was actually surprised that the number was this good, because some patients were just so sick. Just the physio entered the room, they crashed sometimes.
No, COVID was its own beast. But I think there's so much value in saying we have this subset of COVID patients, or there's certain acuity of COVID patients, but we're not going to project that into all patients. You maintain your baseline culture. Yeah. Dr. Needham mentioned that it was a recent study from Johns Hopkins looking at one of their more advanced units, and it showed that they too were able to preserve their culture during COVID. So we hypothesized that the units that had a good baseline culture were able to continue to provide this approach during COVID. But we haven't captured this in the research, but likely the units that did not have a strong foundation were not able to bring in early mobility during COVID.
Yes, I think that's true. Yeah. But for us, what also helped certainly is that, but this was also established, it belongs to the culture. Every patient is screened by a physio every day. And we managed to do that during the pandemic because physios started working in two shifts. So we still managed to see, well, physiotherapy started on day one for all patients in our study. So again, I think that was another thing. It was a culture before already, but we had to improve or increase shifts and increase our working hours during COVID. But it was something that was established before and belonged to the culture, but that was certainly helpful.
And that's pretty much opposite of what a lot of teams did. Maybe from what I've heard in the United States, your workload increased, your patients got sicker, you were in a crisis, and so you readjusted physio to compensate for that. But what happened in a lot of units is that all of these things changed and the decision was made in a lot of units to take out physical and occupational therapists.
Yeah, because it was too dangerous, right? It happened in Europe, I think, as well.
Yeah, and then you guys said, wait, let's think about this.
Yes.
These are sick patients, and they especially need us.
Exactly. We were there quite at the beginning, actually, and we set two goals. We said one goal is we're going to help prone, and also to ensure that the positioning is well done, that we do not have pressure, source, and everything. So physios assisted with proning, but the second goal, and both were on an equal standing, was rehabilitation, because if you do not get the flow going, no one will leave the hospital anymore. And so
that's really what a lot of hospitals quickly saw. They said, yeah, we have some survivors, but we don't know what to do with them. And now all the rehab centers are either closed or full from our past survivors.
If you've been listening to this podcast, you're likely convinced that sedation and mobility practices in the ICU need to change. The ICU community is facing incredible difficulty with the trauma from the pandemic, staffing crisis, and burnout. We cannot afford to continue practices that result in poor patient outcomes, more time in the ICU, higher healthcare costs, and greater workload for the ICU team. Yet the prospect of changing decades of beliefs, practices, and culture across all disciplines of the ICU is a daunting task. How does this transformation start? It can begin with a consultation with me to discuss your team's current practices, barriers, and to formulate a plan to help your ICU become an awake and walking ICU. I help teams master the ABCDEF bundle through education, consulting, simulation training, and bedside support. Let's work together to move your team into the future of evidence-based ICU care. Click the link in the show notes of this episode to find out more.
And we don't know how to get them out of here.
Yes, and so this was really a major goal to get new space in the ICU. So as soon as stable, sit up, and then they already left the ICU. So maybe you saw in the article, we didn't do a lot of standing and walking, but this was also because of our very high flow. Patients sit up and they leave the unit.
You'd get them off the ventilator and you'd get them out to rehabilitate elsewhere.
Yes, or in the acute care hospital or transfer to another hospital.
Do you know how often you had tracheostomies?
We had a lot of tracheostomies. Actually, I just see it here. In our sample, it was 1/3.
Okay. So do you have a culture of doing tracheostomies sooner?
Pretty soon. I think compared to the US, it is sooner, yes.
Okay. And there were studies coming out during COVID showing that earlier tracheostomy resulted in better outcomes. But my thought is that that's likely because when we do tracheostomy, we then take off sedation and mobilize patients.
That's true as well. Yeah,
Is the benefit in the tracheostomy, or is it in discontinuing sedation sooner and mobilizing sooner? Myth that a tracheostomy makes that safer and more feasible, even though there's nothing to support that.
in our unit is also a bit, I guess there's still the barrier. I guess it is mostly nurses, but I don't want to judge too much, but of the tube still being uncomfortable and just like they really care for patients and mm-hmm. they do not want them hurt. So it's still the feeling that the tube is worse for patients, though we mobilize patients with tubes. It's not that, but we mobilize more easily with a tracheostomy, of course. But yeah. The culture is really 10 days, you get a tracheostomy.
Okay.
Sometimes they were even too unstable to get a tracheostomy. I remember some that were.
Well, that can absolutely happen. Yeah, with those severe COVID patients that really struggle for a long time. In this awake and walking ICU, they could they've said, looking back at the pandemic, they could probably count on maybe one hand how many tracheostomies they had. And they had hundreds and hundreds of COVID patients, but that was because they kept them pretty mobile and strong throughout the time and rarely sedated them, but there were times that they did have to be sedated. But they quickly rehabilitated them. So it's just interesting to see how each team practices differently. And those barriers are very similar. You know, the belief that the tracheostomy is more comfortable and therefore, I'm sure it is.
There are other problems after, of course.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well,
yeah, I guess also with the tube, you have probably problems with the larynx.
The larynx, you have stenosis, you have bleeding. I mean, there's like a 13% complication rate just in the hospital. And I can't remember what percentage of readmissions are from those tracheostomies. So they come with a price, but we don't think about that in the moment when we are really trying to be compassionate and say, I don't want to take sedation off. I don't want to disrupt their comfortable sleep.
Well, I can surely say that the sedation is not a cause for the tracheostomy in our unit. So really it is weaning. If the weaning doesn't advances quickly, then the tracheostomy is discussed. So it is not a question of sedation or mobilization. So the tube is not a barrier for that.
Absolutely. And yeah, your team from day one, you guys are deeply part of that discussion saying, how are we, the second you intubate someone, you're there discussing how are we going to get them extubated?
Yes. And I guess if the physio is on the unit already on day one, you always remind them to have recovery in mind. So they look at you and they already think, just intubated, cannot mobilize. But they, I think it is the process behind it. So they see you and they, the physio is also there. Ah, yes, we need to think about recovery. I think that helps.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Because there's so much going on during critical illness and really nurses and a lot of physicians, the main focus is in the moment to keep them alive for that moment, to focus on these certain organ failures and certain problems that are going on. But someone needs to be there saying, okay, while you're thinking about that, let's step out. And may I suggest that we look at this big picture, and I'm here to guide that. So the fact that that's a physiotherapist in your unit is really powerful. And to do that so promptly, it shows in your data that it changes outcomes or changes practices, which we know changes outcomes. What else, what do you envision for the rest of the ICU community?
Well, I think I really wish us good teamwork, because I think it was also the teamwork very much, because it was not just the physios that mobilized. I had a medical doctor, in fact, the chief physician, helped me mobilize a patient to standing because no one else was available. So that was really the teamwork. And I think if we all work together, we can achieve much more and improve the quality of life also at a later state of our patients. I'm pretty sure it will improve outcomes. So yes, I wish everyone teamwork, I guess.
I love it.
And what the basis.
Absolutely. This cannot happen otherwise. And I love what Christiane Perme says. She's in Texas and she's a well-known physical therapist that has pioneered walking patients on ventilators for decades. And she says that mobility is everyone's job.
Exactly. Absolutely. I mean, as a physio, I cannot go there. I mean, this patient, I remember him so well. He wanted to stand up. He was still ventilated on ECMO actually. And Well, this patient, we sat with him on the edge of the bed, and he wanted to stand up and do some steps on place. And the chief physician came by, and we needed a hand, and he was just there and helped us. I think that's teamwork. And he also felt responsible to achieve this.
I love that. Heidi Engel has residents follow her as part of their training. They have to do a shift, or I don't know how many shifts, with her. And they are just floored. They say, I had no idea that this is what you did. I didn't know how much you knew or how much you did for patients. And then they develop that skill set and they get excited about those practices.
That's nice.
And what better way to lead that than to say, if you need help, I'm here.
Yes, I guess teamwork does improve if you also know what the others do and if you assist. We actually, since COVID, the COVID pandemic, we have now medical students who assist in the shifts, and they also assist with sitting up and mobilization. And this is our future. So I'm really hopeful that they also bring something to their practice, because they assist with nurses and physios, and I'm hopeful that this will also improve teamwork.
Oh, that's brilliant. Bring in the med students. Are you hearing that, US? Follow that model. No, that's great experience, because they get to really be familiar with the lines and the tubes and have real patient interactions. I mean, besides bed bath, maybe, like, what's more intimate than having to really be literally hands-on with a patient?
That's true.
And preserving their function, you know, the very basic skills. It's extremely intimate, and you capture the humanity of those patients and of the whole project that you're working on there. So for physicians to be trained that way, that will be a huge impact on the future culture.
Yes. And I also see, mobilization also brings humanity back. You see the first time the patient again, and he's not just lying there, not moving, not participating. And when patients sit up again, they feel more humane. And also you are more in contact. This one patient I just told you about, he was doing Sudoku on the edge of the bed. And like, he couldn't talk because he was still ventilated, but he was in contact with everyone. And that was also because we started to mobilize. And that's why the physician helped. Because they see a human.
I love that. And I really think you've captured well the culture of a unit that really prioritizes the patient as a person. And that's something that does come with time and experience. I think we all have to appreciate when we have a really established culture of automatic, deep, prolonged sedation, no mobility, it takes a process of evolution to change that perspective and to develop that skill set. It's really overwhelming and daunting for people initially to take sedation off, to avoid sedation, then to mobilize them. But what you've described is a team that has done this for many years. So even when something new came along, like COVID-19, and it was scary and it was hard and patients were sick, your culture and that skill set and expertise that your team had developed still carried through, and especially applied to COVID-19 patients.
Yes, and it was really new, because we were a team and we knew what each other's skills was and how we can help each other. I actually just thought about something else, about turning sedation off. And because sometimes I think it's even helpful if we sit them up a bit in the bed, a little turn to the side, one foot already on the floor, and then we stop sedation only. It really helps them when they wake up to be a bit in a sitting position. It's actually quite an interesting approach that we sometimes also use during COVID.
That is brilliant. Absolutely. When I really didn't appreciate this until I played a patient in a scenario at a conference. And when I really got into character and just really embodied this scenario of being delirious and confused, being 30 degrees in the bed, even though I wasn't delirious, right? And I wasn't actually intubated, it felt so vulnerable. And I knew these people around me, I still felt
that's
super
a good
vulnerable.
Point.
and when they're like towering over you and you're at this really helpless position, it's scary. And so I've learned from some of my colleagues that have a lot of experience with tilt tables, these tilt beds. They're having them tilted, standing up, and then they take sedation off. And I said that it totally helps. So what you're sharing, it absolutely validates that. And so that's going to be another tool in the box, right? To say
exactly. Yeah. I didn't even think that it's vulnerability as well, but it fully applies, I think. Yeah. Yeah. You're much more at eye level.
Yeah. And you're engaging with your environment. Cause I have often experienced that when patients are agitated and they're delirious, sitting them up at the side of the bed is magic.
Yeah, usually
standing, walking, they just, I mean, they can still be delirious, but the agitation improves. Everyone's reaffirming this to me. They start to make eye contact, follow commands. You've seen it, but many of our teams are not trained that way. That's the last thing they would ever do. They want the patient to be awake following commands before they get them up.
Yes.
But I think that is such a barrier and a disservice to the patient and our clinicians. I'm like, you're taking away one of the biggest tools to get patients to that point, which is setting them up. So you're So you would say the RAS like -1, maybe -2. You get them up outside of the bed and you then finalize that last little leap in the sedation.
Even extubate the patient actually at the edge of the bed. You cannot do that with weak patients, but with COPD, for example, or then.
A lot of my extubations have been in the chair.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of times they'll walk around the unit, they sit in the chair, and there's no need to cross your fingers when you extubate them.
Patients often say they can breathe better when they sit.
Oh, yep. You hear it all the time, too.
Yeah, it's not just after they sat up, because usually it's exhausting, but when they sit and they've recaptured their breath, many people can breathe better.
Absolutely. I have people write on the clipboard saying, can I get to the chair? Can I please get to the chair? And it seems to be, I mean, this is just my observation. I saw it a lot with patients with higher ventilator settings. One patient just a few months ago, I was working with a team and he was on a PEEP of 14.80%, and they were about to prone and paralyze him. And we said, hold on, let's get him up first and see how he does. Got him to the chair. An hour later, he was down to a PEEP of 12.50%.
Oh, wow.
Just from sitting in the chair.
I cannot really say that. I'm still waiting actually for the studies that compare lung protective ventilation with non-lung. I guess that's
hear that ARDS net. Do you hear that ARDS net? We are all waiting. That really, those ARDS studies are from the 90s.
Yes. And lung protective ventilation seems plausible to me, but of course, now we have also brain protection interventions like mobilization. So I guess we need to find out again how we can do both, maybe.
Absolutely. Those ARDS, this is a whole other topic, but those ARDS studies were done comparing high volumes that we were doing and high PEEPs that we were doing in the 90s to lower volumes. But all of those patients were sedated and I think usually paralyzed.
Yes. And this, of course, in Europe, lung protective ventilation is still very important.
Yep, absolutely.
But I think we found a good measure during the COVID-19 pandemic. In the first few days, it was really lung protective ventilation, proning. But then after 4 days, they sat. So I think it was quite a good balance to have both.
Yep. So it wasn't just, we can't let them take any independent breaths. We can't let them exceed that volume ever. While they're on the ventilator, it was, we're going to follow some of this research. You know, it's antiquated, but we're going to keep this very controlled initially. And then we're going to look at the big picture and make sure we take care of the rest of the body too.
Yes. And of course, also our doctors, they really looked at all the compliance parameters and how that was also always a very important parameter to see how we can progress.
Well, I am really proud of your team. Thank you so much for publishing that research and just showing that it was possible and done to have patients mobilized fairly early on during the pandemic. Thank you for all that your team is doing and all that you do as a physiotherapist. You're, as you can tell in your data, you are saving lives.
Thank you very much for inviting us. And I'm also very happy with this team.
Thank you so much. And congratulations, Switzerland. Schedule a consultation for your ICU, as well as find supportive resources such as the free ebook, case studies, episode citations, and transcripts, please check out the website www.daytonicuconsulting.com.